Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are coming to you from our top secret headquarters at Project Quantum Leap, but you can find us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And please do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button on iTunes. Well, here we are, ladies and gentlemen. We are recording our very first episode of the new year. You will have already heard one episode that we actually had in the can prior to the holiday season, but now that we are indeed here, post-Christmas, post-New Year's,
yes.
Hope everyone had a wonderful, wonderful holiday.
Yeah. So further confusion, so we're recording two episodes today.
Yes.
The first one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, full disclosure here, because a lot of podcasters put episodes in the can. So we're recording Jimmy, this episode,
yep.
First. Last week's episode, we're actually recording later this afternoon just because guests timing the way it
So way it in the spirit out. Of the show, we're really just doing things.
We're just jumping all
around
out of
time,
order. Chronologically,
space,
we're
know.
Going correct because we're 1964.
That's
next
right.
week, or last week, we were 1974. And that's all out of order.
Yeah.
Never mind. Here we go. Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, the
Indeed.
Quantum Leap podcast with Sam.
And Dennis.
And returning guest, Christopher J. Stewart.
I'm back, ladies and gentlemen.
Who appeared last season. Truth.
That's right.
And so we're back for Jimmy.
We are indeed. Also in the interest of full disclosure, Sam had a really good time last night.
Sam Fain.
My wife's sister and her boyfriend are in town, and they're actually getting ready to leave for Spain. In a few days, and they're going to be there for quite a few months. So we went out and painted the town red, had a wonderful time. It's left me feeling the effects of a night out on the town, though. So I'm a little foggy. But that said,
he is like Al Calavici in the pilot episode of Quantum Leap, hungover all the time.
That's right. I'm not quite as bad as, you know, right hand of God Al needing to sleep on a, you know, on the... See, I can't even come up with the words to describe.
It's all good. Christopher and I got you back. Also, in the interest of full disclosure, if you hear the static in the background, that is the heater. We are in Chicago. It's double digits
I know.
Today.
Yeah,
it's a heat wave.
The first time being double digits in the last several days here.
It might actually get up to 33 degrees today.
It's
so.
A goddamn heat wave.
Yeah.
Right?
So we are covering Jimmy.
That's right, Jimmy.
This weekend.
Directed by James Whitmore Jr., written by Paul M. Bellew, and aired November the 22nd, 1989. Our leap date is indeed October 14th, 1964, as Dennis mentioned. The leapy is Jimmy LaMotta. We're in the LaMotta household as things open up. Why don't you give us that wonderful TV guide description?
The TV guide description is pretty tame this time. Sam becomes a mentally handicapped man in 1964, and he has to find a way to an acceptance at home and in his new workplace or be sent back to an institution.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
That's a pretty straightforward description.
Yeah.
No jokes, no puns.
No.
There we go.
No. I'm surprised they didn't start it off with, like, on a very special episode. You know.
This is, you know, I will say, this is, aside from Color of Truth, this is probably... the first very special episode of Quantum Leap that falls into that that genre.
And I would say that that's not a knock, by the way. But I would even maybe throw in the last episode, Thou Shalt Not, into that list a little bit as well. The way that it deals with grief, I think, is
sure.
kind of interesting. But for the most part, if you're looking at other TV shows that would do their very special episodes, this is probably one that would fall more into that category than any other.
And I can't remember how it was initially advertised because I didn't watch the show at this point. Like, I came into like a little bit later in the second season. But I do know that this was a show that they reran a lot.
Yes,
especially like the summer after the second season. Like NBC did an entire week, Quantum Leap week, where they ran an episode every single night, which was kind of unheard of at the time, but they were really trying to get people
to watch it,
into the show, and this was like one of the episodes that they featured.
And, you know, it's interesting because I seem to remember also that when Sci-Fi Channel would do any of their marathons, it was usually in the lineup as well. You know, not always, but I remember there was one in particular, actually, that they did on Oscar night. And the reason I remember that is because I was having a bunch of people over to watch the Oscars because, you know, when you're in a theater department in school, that's what you do. And so we were having everybody over. So I was in college, so there was going to be drinks and etc. But I found out there was a Quantum Leap marathon during the day, so I invited everybody to come over and watch Quantum Leap marathon. And
nice,
exactly. But yeah, so this is definitely it's a great episode. I think we're probably all going to agree on that. Certainly doesn't necessarily mean that it's perfect. And I think that one of the things that really interests me, and I would love to talk just briefly about,
this is going to be a 3-hour episode, folks.
Is the leap in. I think the leap in, it's one of the more extended leap ins, because the leap out and Thou Shalt Not into this is, you know.
They chop up.
Yeah, they edit quite a bit of content out, actually. Mm-hmm. So that when you see the episode proper and you get the leap in before you know the credits roll and everything, it's definitely thicker, if you will, than the end of Thou Shalt Not.
I want to say it was a couple of minutes, because at one point I was like, is this the episode? And then he leaped out and I was like, oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting to see the, because a lot of that stuff is, you know, stuff Frank, where, you know, Frank is telling him to get ready, put your pants on, wear your shoes.
Yeah, but there is a nice moment where Corey comes in, shoots him with the ray gun.
Yeah,
you're supposed to die
now. You're supposed to die now.
And Sam improvising just as like this great, like, I don't know what I'm doing, but
yeah.
It is interesting, like, because I forgot like how much they set it up for you to think that he is a kid.
A kid, yes. Yeah.
The way he is dressed and the bunk beds and even the music has this childlike thing to it. Like, they're really setting you up down that path, and then it turns into something else.
I fell right into that fucking trap. I was like, oh, I even said to Nicole, I was like, oh, he must be like a 10-year-old kid. And then come to find out he wouldn't. I was like, ah, they fucking got me.
Well, even Jessica, it's funny, when Jessica, she's not joining us today, but when she saw the episode, or bits and pieces of it, she didn't watch the whole thing with me, but when she saw the beginning, she was like, oh, that's interesting, thinking that he was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, come find out it's not. She's like, oh. Which kind of brings me to the next point. The word retarded gets used a lot.
So that was the thing that I was going to bring up, and in our setup before we started recording, I meant to bring this up. Like, are we going to say the word or not? Because some people have some really strong feelings about that.
Absolutely. Oh. And it's one of those things where clearly, like, with Color of Truth, there was a word that we weren't going to say.
Yeah.
Just not going to say.
Yeah.
With this, it's, you
let's
know,
do something similar. Yeah. Okay. Just say R-bomb. Instead of
R-bomb?
The R-bomb.
We can do
okay.
The R-bomb.
There we go. Yeah. So we'll call it the R-bomb. And it's like, because, you know, as I was starting to watch this episode the other night, I looked up the history of the word.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason why the R-bomb is more acceptable to say as opposed to the other word is, like, the other word, like, it was always an oppressive word.
Yeah,
like,
right.
It was never, you know, there was never any other use for the word. But the R-bomb... Thank you for that. The R-bomb did have this weird overlapping for about 20 to 30 years where it was both
like a
pejorative. It was a slang term to call someone stupid or an idiot or whatever. But it was also the clinical definition for someone with an intellectual disability.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, when they dropped it the first time, how many people cringed? Because I had no idea.
You know, at the time, though, when this episode aired, like, it was still acceptable, like, to use that word if you were not using it as a pejorative,
right,
but using it, like, clinically to describe someone, it was still acceptable to say that word.
And I think the thing that, for me, that was interesting about it is in remembering the episode and knowing specifically the leap in when Sam, you know, looks in the mirror and, like, after Frank has kind of told him what he says to say to the boss or whatever, like, Sam says it. And in my memory, I had given that quite a negative connotation. Then when seeing it actually in the episode, I was like, no, I get it. Like, because, you know, Scott Bakula delivers it with a certain sensitivity, and it does, like, it doesn't, there's no kind of, oh God, I can't believe this. You know what I mean? Like, it's just very much, it's just sort of like statement of fact and kind of like, I don't know how to handle this. Yeah. So it actually, oddly enough, it did not bother me at all. It didn't bother me when Frank said it first, because Frank says it first about, like, you know, remember telling you're not the R-bomb, that you're slow. And then Sam says, you know, I'm the R-bomb. And so it's like, for some reason it didn't bother me at all, because it was, to me, it did feel a little bit more. And it's interesting the line that Frank straddles with that, because for him the word just in general, regardless of whether or not it's any sort of clinical usage or if it is the pejorative, like, he just doesn't want to hear the word. He doesn't want to think of Jimmy that way. He doesn't want anybody else to say that word to Jimmy. He doesn't, you know, so it's really kind of interesting. Whereas when Sam and Al talk about it later in the episode, to them there's not, they'll use the word, but not in, you know, not in the sense of, you know, not in the pejorative sense, but at the same time,
they're using it clinically.
And
there are so many, like, strong feelings about it. Like, there's a whole campaign, I think it started like 3 or 4 years ago, called Spread the Word to End the Word. And in that movement, like, they treat it very similarly to, like a racial slur. Yeah.
Yeah, it, you know, and the thing is that it's like, I feel, I could be completely wrong about this. This is just, you know, my hungover brain throwing stuff out there. But I feel like with, you know, a racial epithet or a word that is used, you know, against homosexuals or something like that, I think that it's, those words in a way have been taken back and used in casual or you know, humorous situations by a person of color or by a person of a different sexuality, and they kind of have almost empowered themselves to be able to use those words while other people can't. Whereas this is a word where I don't think that would not happen in the same way because of the condition with which we're talking about. You know, because it's not, you know, if someone has some sort of
mental disability.
Thank you. I'm telling you, it's going to be a struggle today.
Yeah.
If somebody does have a mental disability, you know, they may not be able to understand if they're using that word. You know, they might not be able to have the same context that a person of color using a certain word in casual conversation with another person of color is going to have. Whereas if you have two people that are mentally disabled, they might not necessarily be able to use that word in the same way, is what I'm saying.
That's interesting, I find, because my ex-wife, we both went the same path of, like, we did community college for a couple years, and then we went to university, and we met at university. But when she was in community college, she worked in a day facility with the mentally handicapped.
Okay.
So she had very strong feelings about the R word. Like,
sure.
And, like, when we first knew each other, like, I think there were a couple times, like, I dropped it in, you know, like in conversation, like he did sometimes, and she expressed very strong feelings about it, and that's where I first learned that, you know, some people, you know, really have strong feelings. You don't use it. And then after we got married, and then we moved back to Louisville, where she is from, she went back and worked at that facility even for the first year or so of our marriage. But I bring that up to say, she said, like, one of the really interesting things about working with that population is actually, most of them, even if they do have a very limited mental capacity, like even if they have the mental capacity of just a 5-year-old, they know enough to know that they are mentally disabled. They know enough to know what a shitty hand they got dealt.
Yep.
And sometimes they will play it.
Sure.
because the thing is, like, they know they can do it. Like, I can't remember specifics, but, like, very specifically, like, she worked with one person that when they were out in public, like, sometimes he would just go on a tantrum and, like, pull and grab her hair and do things, and, like, he knew he wasn't supposed to do it, but he knew he could get away with it because of his limited mental capacity and how he was viewed.
Yeah. Interesting.
I don't know if I have a point much beyond that, but just to bring up a point. She's like, the interesting thing is, like, sometimes, like, yeah, they do understand the shitty hand they got dealt, and they will play that.
Yeah. Yeah, I, like I said, the ravings of a lunatic over here, but it's just a thought that I had about, you know, that the way certain words do hold the power, and sometimes people can, you know, like I say, take them back, and it does make you wonder if that's a possibility, if it's even, you know, again, I think most importantly, if it's even something that would be a desired possibility, you know, from anyone in that community, much less anyone who's, you know, caregiver to anyone in that community, but... Mm-hmm. All that said,
one more tangent before we jump into the meat of the episode is, you know, something I forgot. At the same time that this episode of TV came on, a couple of months before the series Life Goes On debuted on, what was it, ABC, I think?
Yeah, sure was.
And it was...
Corky?
Corky. Mm-hmm. And he was the first character and the first actor with Down syndrome to be featured as a major Corky character.
Yeah. All these feelings are flooding.
So I say that to say, like, I wonder how much of this episode
was influenced by that.
It's like, oh, we're gonna kind of do our take on this.
And let's face it, you know, I mean, the actor that they got to play the mirror image, Brad Silverman, you know, was an actor that I I'm not quite sure what the clinical, you know, definition would be of whatever, but I mean, he was someone who had, you know, diminished mental capacity and so I think that, I don't know. Maybe there's a time when if an episode like this were to air, that mirror image wouldn't have been that. So maybe Life Goes On did have something to do with that. Maybe not. I don't know. I'm just, you know, speculating purely here, but, yeah, you know, that's interesting. I had thought of that before, but not right now. The funny thing is that that was another show that we used to watch in our house, and that was one of those things that I feel like my mom and my sister and I, like, we would all get together and watch it, and then sometimes it would just be like my sister and I watching it, and, you know, watch it for quite a while. And I feel like in some ways that show was the first time that I'd ever. There were a lot of things depicted on that show that I would have been like 8 years old, I think, for me, would have been the first time that those things came into my awareness in that way. You know, like, for instance, I was aware of the AIDS epidemic at that point in my life because, I mean, how could you not be being, you know, hell, I feel like by the time I was 4 or 5 years old, I knew what it was because it was 1985.
Yeah.
But by 1989, to see it depicted on television because there was a character that had HIV on the show, and that was something that, you know, for like a primetime family drama, if you will. I mean, that was a big deal.
That's really big.
In addition to, you know, to Corky, but yeah, interesting. That's all I got.
All right. Well, let's jump into the meat of the episode. So yes.
Actually, tell your Frank story real quick because you've got a good Frank story.
The actor plays Frank, John DiAquano, a friend of mine who lives in Chicago, Aaron. He actually had John DiAquano as an acting teacher in college.
Yeah.
And at one point, as part of some project, my friend Aaron, like, he directed a short film that, like, took place like at a backyard party, and he got John to do him a favor and just be in his party. Movie, like, as a guest, just like as another guest at the party.
Awesome.
So yeah,
that's very cool. Yeah. And I think he's pretty great in this episode. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think that one of the things that Thou Shalt Not does as well, and I just think that there's been a string of them so far, is that we've really gotten away from some of the more hammy, over the top acting that we kind of saw in parts of the first season, for sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and early on in the second season, maybe, I feel like we mentioned a few episodes ago, this is sort of starting to be the sweet spot of the show. Mm-hmm. And there's just some really great performances. The writing, you know, might be fairly basic in some instances, but mm-hmm. it's usually elevated by the performances or, you know, the stakes in some way. So I think that this is a good example of that, because I do think that everybody does a really good job in this episode. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, there's maybe a couple of times where they're milking a little bit, but
for sure,
you know,
yeah.
but for the most part, yeah,
it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
John DiAquano was also in Sequest, DSV.
That's right.
Do you remember that show?
Woo-hoo!
Which came on the year after Quantum Leap ended, and that was a show that I really tried to get into, because after Quantum Leap ended, I desperately needed to find my next Quantum Leap. Yeah. Like the next show that I was really into, and I tried to make it Sequest, and that just didn't happen.
Oh!
You know, I stuck with it for the first season.
Totally. I did. I loved the first season. It was like when... did you watch the show, Chris?
I vaguely remember seeing a episode or two, but I know exactly what you
mean. I loved the show for the first season, but then for the second season, what they did was like they fired off most of the older actors, and yeah. I can't remember if John DiAquano was one of them. But they fired off most of the older actors, and they brought in a bunch of young people because they were trying to kidify the show to appeal to the younger audience.
Wait, this is a sci-fi thing that they were trying to kidify?
Yeah. And so actually, by doing that, I watched the second season, but I wasn't so much into the second season.
So did they try to dumb it down?
Yeah, I mean, they try to dumb it down and bring in like some younger hot people to try to make it more of a more of a thing. Because like in the first season, Royce D. Applegate, who played the sheriff in Color of Truth. Hmm. He was on the show. He was one of the actors who definitely got fired at the end of the first season.
And so did, DiAquano.
I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing his last. John.
John got fired. Yeah, John did get fired. His character, Ben Krieg, was given the axe, but he did come back in an episode at the very beginning of the third season, which is by the time that Michael Ironside had taken over.
Was it?
Roy
Schneider had no love for that series.
He loved it during the first season because he had a lot of input.
Oh,
it was
okay.
He was one of the people that initially was just sort of like, I don't want to do this show. And they're like, well, but you don't understand. It's not going to be Star Trek underwater. We're actually going to, you know, have like a message and talk about, you know, the ecosystem. We're going to talk about it. And he was like, all right, fine, I'll do it. Actually kind of makes the pilot episode a little bit more fun in a way because they have to convince his character to come
captain the ship.
Yeah.
I got a lot of comparisons to Star Trek, but also people ought to forget the 60s series, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Mm-hmm. And some critics they called Sequest Voyage to the Bottom of the Ratings.
Ooh. It started strong. Mm-hmm. Here's what happened, and I remember this, and I can remember being torn even at the time. It aired opposite Lois and Clark.
Yes, it did.
And so there was a big fight in the ratings over which show was going to win. And for most of the first season, Sequest won.
Wow.
But by the time season two came around, Lois and Clark just left it in the dust.
Sequest won over Terry Hatcher's fine ass?
I did. I really did. Which, there's another connection to Quantum Leap right there.
Oh, there we go. Yes.
But yeah, it really did. If you look at it, it's kind of funny. But I don't think it ever got to a point where like Lois and Clark's late ratings were low. It's just that Sequest was beating it on a fairly consistent basis. But then over the summer, Lois and Clark just blew up. And part of it had to do with the fact that Terry Hatcher and Dean Cain were on the cover of everything.
That's right.
Every magazine. They were everywhere.
And much more photogenic than Roy Schneider.
Right, exactly. And so, God rest his soul. It was. I remember that at the time because I was much the same way. I was looking for that. I needed to have, you know, post Quantum Leap fix, and Sequest was on NBC, and NBC wasn't going to steer me wrong, you know. And I didn't know how I felt about seeing Superman on TV because I was just a huge fan of the movies with Christopher Reeve. So like, I wasn't quite sure how I felt, you know. And then,
how do you feel about Dean Cain?
Well, now
that's how
today,
everybody feels.
I hope he and Fox News have a long and lovely marriage.
Really? Come on, Superman. You know what? Let's not even get into that.
I just can't. How could he? I don't know.
Anyway.
Do you know Dean Cain? Like, he's a big, like,
a Trump supporter. Yes, no, yes.
No.
And you know, no offense to Trump supporters, but offense. I don't think.
Yeah, I was going to say, no. Sorry. You can, you know.
Yeah. I did see one cute moment in the news recently, like him and Brandon Routh. Is that how you say his name?
Brandon Routh.
Yeah, they wound up on the same flight together, a few seats away from each other. So one of them like took a selfie with the other Superman like in the background, like them both kind of, like a weird look to the camera, like two Supermans in one place.
That's funny.
At once,
I think. Oddly enough, I do think that Dean Cain is actually playing Supergirl's father on the new Supergirl TV show.
That is right.
He did appear. Yes, yeah. And Helen Slater is playing.
Yeah,
Supergirl,
which I dig. Like
mom.
That's cool.
Yeah,
secret of my success, man. Helen Slater could have just. I was a young boy and didn't know what I was feeling, but...
Oh! Alan Slater.
Yeah, just saying.
But anyway, Quantum Leap. So we jump from the first scene to breakfast.
Right, well, which one of the things that gets set up in that first scene that I don't know that we explicitly stated is that Frank has gotten Jimmy a job interview.
Mm-hmm.
And, at the dock. And it's, yeah, at the dock. And it's, you know, super important opportunity. And Frank is clearly, like, you know, really trying to hammer it into Jimmy. It's like, now, look, you need to do this. You have to do this. And remember, you're not the R-bomb. Just slow. Just, you know, and this continues, you know, throughout throughout the opening scenes. But, yeah, then we get to breakfast and we meet Connie, the wife.
Hold on. I have a question about... this is 1964, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How good of a gig is a dock position in 1964?
You know, that is a good question. Mm-hmm. I would think because most likely it's an opportunity to go union or be union, because a dock workers union, you know, is a thing. I mean, I don't know what it would be like in Oakland, but I'm thinking that it would probably be a decent job.
Mm-hmm. So setting up his brother with a job at the dock is basically their ticket to get out of any financial issues they might have.
Well, sure. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that even comes into play as the episode goes on, and I don't know that this is it's explicitly stated, but you can imagine that with some of the friction between, like, Connie and Frank, that some of that might be coming from Connie thinking, like, well, we've got another mouth to feed now. We've got, you know, and now if he's able to bring in income, absolutely would change things for them.
Well, I mean, and I think it's actually more or less stated, like, they took Jimmy out of the institution with the intent of getting him the job. Like Frank, he was well enough liked by his boss in the job, like, he felt confident enough that he could take Jimmy out of the institution and get him set up with the job fairly quickly.
And you can tell very early on, too, that this is, like, this is a goal that Frank has had. Like, Frank has wanted, you know, he wanted to get Jimmy out of there, that he was literally working to get his brother out of the institution, to set him up, to get him the job, to get, you know what I mean? Like, this is something that I think, you know, even though he's a married father, that he's his brother's keeper as well. And so that this was extremely important to him to get Jimmy out and get him a job. And the one question that I do have is I wonder if, because I just watched the episode, I can't remember if it's addressed, but I almost wonder, would Frank let Jimmy, like, get a place of his own? You know what I mean?
I mean, it's set up so much, like, they talk about, and I didn't take the time to do the research to how, like, the mentally handicapped were integrated into society or not, but just taking the episode at face value and what the script says, like, at this time, the mentally handicapped were not integrated into society, they were just put into institutions. So I think Jimmy getting set up with a place of his own, he's probably years off from that.
Yeah.
If ever. So, I think, like, the end goal is, like, you know, he is going to be living with them. It's just, you know, he needs to be a productive member of society.
I mean, I just Googled it just for the heck of it, and there's an article here talking about social integration of mentally handicapped persons from 1981. So, you got to think that in 81, you know, there are articles coming out about, you know, about this subject. So yeah, in 64, it would probably be very, very difficult. So I have a feeling that more than likely it was sort of like, if he's, you know, if I'm getting him out, he's with us, you know, he's going to live with us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And having an extra family member stay with you is a strain, no matter what.
Yeah, it can absolutely be.
But anyway, so at breakfast, we're also introduced to Corey.
Yes. Well, we've seen Corey before, but now we get...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, more introduced.
Shoots him with his ray gun.
That's absolutely correct. So we get to introduce, like, their relationship, him and Uncle Jimmy's relationship. And
yes.
There's a moment of reading the newspaper and Sam taking one section and starting to read it. And everybody's like, well, what?
Yeah, well, what are you,
like,
doing?
You like the funny papers. What are you doing?
Well, it's interesting to me because one of the things that we've talked about before is how people would view, in particular, how people would view the person that Sam has leapt into after he leaps out. And there are things that Sam does in the episode that I don't imagine anyone would be scratching their head over, you know, like, oh, Jimmy couldn't do that. And even in this moment, like, you get the sense that Frank, like, at first is a little bewildered by it, but almost is also just sort of like, oh, he's pulling my leg. He's like, he's getting ready for his big interview. It's like, you know, he's going to start a job. He's going to read the paper like his big, you know, his
brother
does.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I thought.
Yeah.
Just trying to be like his big brother and do the things that his big brother is doing.
But we as the audience know that he's
actually reading the paper.
Yeah.
And he's doing it so he can find out
where he is
in the day. Yeah. But it is a funny moment also because then he tells him, you usually look at the comics. And so he hands him, you know, the funny pages, and Corey offers to read the comics to Sam. Mm-hmm. We also get the information that he's only been there for a couple of weeks. Which I think is also, you know, interesting. It's like this is still kind of a new situation for them to have Jimmy in the house. But it's just a really, really nice moment. It's like one of those great, as a guest appearance by Al.
Hello.
Cat. Yeah, mm-hmm. One of our cats. But anyway, The family dynamic in general, just the relationships, I think, are set up pretty well, especially as far as how, like, Frank just seems like a good guy. You know, a good father, mm-hmm. a good brother. They're having fun. They're joking. They're singing the song about the Cocoa Puffs or mm-hmm. whatever. Like,
he's the kind of person I would want to hang out with. Like, even when he read the paper, he said something along the lines of, "I need to see if I won some money." And his wife was like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" "Oh, I got
the 49ers."
The Niners.
Which by watching that episode that time, what a horrible cover. If I won money, well, if the 49ers won, you just said the same thing. You just clarified your point. You didn't cover yourself at all. Anyway,
And you also get the sense that Connie's a little like, she's a little irritated by the whole thing.
She is not on board.
No. But I will say that one of the things that we definitely get from Connie is that, in contrast to some other characters that we've seen that are having like conflicts, especially if we were to go back to our Americanization of Machiko episode, mm-hmm. and the mother, for instance, she doesn't come off as just like this total awful human being who dislikes Jimmy because he's mentally handicapped, or mm-hmm. you know, she's not bigoted. She's not like, she just is having difficulty adjusting to having another person in the house. Yeah.
She would be perfectly nice if Jimmy was just visiting,
right?
But Jimmy is living with them.
Yeah,
and that's
And she even says later in the episode about how, you know, she's, I feel like she has to take care of another child, you know, basically. And so, yeah, clearly that's going to be difficult for her. Mm-hmm. You know, she's got her son, and, you know, and I think that's another point of contention there. But anyway, that the dynamic is set up really nicely in this opening scene. Mm-hmm. Cats are being mischievous. So at this point, Corey leaves for school. Mm-hmm. And Connie, you know, being the overprotective mother, and she's like, "Come home early, don't be playing down by the wharf," you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Foreshadowing.
Yeah, right. And then Sam, as he gets up, he spills the milk.
Yeah.
And this is something that will continue throughout the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of times where you see something that Sam does, or, you know, breaks something, spills something, whatever, and the context, it makes complete sense. Like, oh yeah, you know, he got bumped into, or this happened.
Sure.
And then there's a couple of times where it's just sort of like, man, Sam's just having a shitty day.
Yeah. Well, at that time, like, it builds up. It's like, yeah. You know, like he says later in the episode, like, if everybody treats you like you're an idiot, like mm-hmm. you're supposed to screw up, yeah, you're gonna.
Right. Right.
That.
That's, yeah. And that was actually a really cool moment that mm-hmm. when he says that, because it does make you start to, it was a moment that I think gave you the opportunity to look at the situation in a different light. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the things that the show, you know, when it does it well, it's just one of the hallmarks of the entire premise of the show, mm-hmm. because it gives us the opportunity to see this sort of like, you know, everyman sort of character, barring the incredible genius that he is.
Yeah.
But this everyman sort of character being put into these different situations, and then kind of like, it's like, oh yeah, imagine if you were treated that way all the time. You know?
Absolutely. So we get to the dock. We get to the job interview. Right?
Well, Al shows up first.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. So we have this scene with Al showing up and Sam telling Al that he is the R-bomb, and Al basically explaining to him like, this is what your mental capacity, what your mental capacity is.
You have the mental capacity of a 12-year-old. You can read, you can write, you can hold a job. Like, Al's coming off very, you know, not only knowledgeable, but very passionate about these things. Like, just kind of like, he's like, you are a normal human being. There is nothing wrong with you.
Yeah, I like he has a line like, you know, you really couldn't tell us you really couldn't tell much difference between you and the rest of us screw ups. I can't remember what the exact line is.
Yeah, well, because he tells, because Sam asks, and this would certainly be a moment where I could, I didn't cringe. None of it really bothered me when I viewed the episode, but I could understand how this particular moment would bother people when Sam asks Al how he should act. Because he doesn't know how to act Arbomb. You know?
Yes. Yeah.
And one of the great response that Al has is act normally.
Yeah.
You know. And then it qualifies
that's not a dig.
It's not a dig. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting because like usually like Al is the one like cracking jokes and everything.
Sure, sure.
And so like Sam is the one who has to like slap his hand and tell him to stop joking around. And like from the very beginning of this episode, Al is being, you know, completely serious and reasonable. And,
yeah.
Yeah. He's the voice of reason.
In a lot of ways.
Talking sense into Sam.
By the way, were you guys looking at what Al was wearing?
Oh, always.
Jesus.
It was very green, and it kind of just fit in with all the greenery of the...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it looked like somebody puked a forest on him.
Oftentimes, these are I mean, in the last episode, he wore an outfit where I swear he looked like a bag of Doritos. Like,
I know, it's just, yeah. You know. It is. I don't know if we've ever, like, brought this up in an episode. Like, it is interesting to know, like, the reason why they dressed Al like that on the show was so, like, for the casual viewer popping in, they wanted Al to be dressed so weird so that people know he does not belong in the time period that Sam is in.
He's from the future.
Yeah. He is.
Wow.
He is future boy.
This is how we're going to dress in the future.
Future man.
So do you think they had a budget for each episode to figure out just how weird they were going to dress?
Oh, I'm sure.
I'm willing to bet there was
I will say about costume. Yeah. It's about this point, like they're hitting their stride with his outfits of just like, this is what Al looks like.
You know, and this is something that we talked about have talked about, depending on your point of view, in
Time Travel.
In Thou Shalt Not, there's some interaction that he has with the hand link. And sort of, there are a lot of those sort of the things that will become just staples of the show that are really starting to appear for the first time.
Sure, yeah.
And the costumes, while we've been seeing costumes, like you're saying, they really started to dial it in here. And it started to get kind of standard, you know? Loud shirt, loud vest, loud tie,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that was kind of the outfit from the waist up, pretty much, that he almost always wore. Every once in a while, you get a little something different here and there, but for the most part, that was it. You know, vest, shirt, tie.
Yeah.
Sam.
There we go. So they have this discussion about how Sam is supposed to behave, and basically he is there to get Jimmy integrated, which did not happen.
Right.
In the 1960s.
And he, you know, and Al, again, gets a little passionate about the fact that at that time people thought it was just much easier to, you know, throw him in an institution, and that was that. Again, Al's just being very compassionate, not only to Sam, but to Jimmy. Which is interesting.
We'll get there.
So now we get to
There's one more reminder, like, of Frank telling Jimmy how he's supposed to
behave. Really drilling
like, don't do this, don't do this. I love Sam's line, can I pick my nose?
Yeah.
No, you can't.
But before that, too, there's this really sweet moment where he's telling him, yes, sir. And, like, you gotta say yes, sir, to the boss. And Sam responds with yes, sir, to Frank. And he's like, no, you don't have to say yes, sir, to me.
And it's like,
okay, Frank.
And it's and like, because I watched that moment and I'm like, Frank, you are not making it any easier because you are drilling him so hard, like... I would be confused by that exchange.
Oh, right, exactly. Well, and we also get the information that, like, Frank has a letter from the doctor. Like, this is, I mean, clearly this is something that he's worked really hard, you know, on his own and with other people to be like, this is okay. And you gotta, in a way, you gotta be like, kudos to that doctor. Like, the doctor's like, yeah, Jimmy can go work on the docks. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's like, all right, cool. And then we get into the office.
To the interview scene and... the boss. I don't know if we ever get the boss's name.
Charlie Samuels.
Charlie, that's it. Yeah, Mr. Samuels. Yeah. And we have the one memorable line. He's looking over his resume. He's like, I don't know. And then he shouts like, I like your brother. I don't think I can give you a job. And Sam's like, I'm slow, not deaf.
Yeah. Yeah, he's like yelling at him. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Charlie is played by Michael Aldridge, who I really like in this. I think he does a great job. And, you know, and the nice thing is you can tell he's conflicted. And at times he's conflicted because he's uneasy about having Jimmy work for him. And then at other times he's conflicted because he's like, Jimmy's a good kid, but I got pressures, you know, all this sort of stuff. He had an interesting career. He actually passed away in 1997. Mm. But before that, he, you know, again, was actually on Life Goes On for a while.
Oh, there we go.
I liked him in this, and I think that this scene is played really, really nicely as well. Mm. By both he and Scott Bakula.
Yeah. But he gets a job, and so we get, like, the nice little musical moment of hugging and celebrating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Frank's ecstatic.
His brother is just so proud of him.
That's
one of the scenes that, like, really captivated me, because, like, you could just tell that he never thought that he would get the job. He thought he was going to screw up, and then when he found out he got the job, he was like, my life is going to be perfect. I'm going to be living. Mm-hmm. My brother's going to be great.
Yeah. He's really, that is the other thing that's cool. Like, he's excited to be, like, at work with his brother.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's like, there's this excitement of just sort of like, Jimmy and I working on the docks together. Like, this is great. Like, Pop can see us now, and, you know, and even brings that up at one point. It's also cool because one of the things that just, like, from a sort of a filmmaking perspective that I enjoyed is that the scene between Jimmy and Charlie actually is left open-ended in a way. Like, you don't ever hear Charlie say, like, you got the job.
You got the job, yeah.
We see Frank and with Sam, and initially, you know, you get that heartbeat of a moment where, like, Sam walks up, and then, you know, you see Frank's face, and then all of a sudden it's like bam, and then what you're talking about, Chris, and it's really nice. I liked it.
And I can't remember, I think we skipped over part, like, even before the interview, like, as they are walking in, we get introduced
to Blue,
played by Michael Madsen.
Michael, you gonna bark all day, little doggy?
Oh god, yeah.
You know, once I found out that Michael Madsen was gonna be in this episode, my ears started.
Do you smell gasoline?
Yeah.
For those that may not be in the know, we're referencing Reservoir Dogs, and Michael Madsen is in that.
Reservoir Dogs, Kill Bill.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The first Sin City movie.
Yes.
For whatever reason, he was not brought back for Sin City 2. I think there was some drama over that. I can't remember what it was about.
He's an interesting fellow.
Yes.
So, could have been all sorts of things.
Could have been some things, yeah.
But he's. But I will, you know, I'll give him this. I mean, he's done some really great.
I was like, look at his IMDb page. Yeah. Like, he's a very prolific person. We're talking about
He's a Chicagoan, by the way.
Yeah,
born and raised in Chicago, Illinois.
Oh, nice. Wow. But we were talking off mic before we started recording. He was in a short-lived TV series. I'm the king of the short-lived TV series.
Basically, if you're a TV producer out there, you don't want Dennis to watch your show.
I don't watch...
If Dennis likes your show,
yeah. I watched one episode of 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter and Kill John Ritter.
Oh, no!
Anyway. Oh. Anyway. So, Michael Madsen, he was in a short-lived TV series from 1998 to 99 called Vengeance Unlimited. And he played Mr. Chapel, and basically he was playing a TV version of his character from Reservoir Dogs, like his dress, that mood. But the gimmick of the series is that if you had been wronged and the justice system failed you and you didn't get justice that way, he was a vigilante who would help you out for either $1 million or a favor that he could redeem any time in the future in his pursuit of helping somebody else out. And by the time the story had started in the series, he had helped enough people that, one, he was very financially set. Enough people had paid him the $1 million that he had, like, unlimited resources as far as technology and everything goes. And he had just a seemingly endless amount of people who owed him favors.
Sure.
And so one of the running...
very much like The Equalizer.
It is, it was The Equalizer. And so, like, one of the running gimmicks of the show is that... because he was just, like, a very scary person, and he did these really weird things, you know, in the interest of getting justice. So a running gimmick of the show is that he would call in a favor, and the person would be terrified. And after the person did the favor... there was always the exchange of him saying, "We're even. I'm out of your life forever." And the other person going, "Thank God."
nice.
And it was a show we're talking about. I won't get into it, but yeah, there were a couple of episodes where things happened where I'm surprised that was on ABC prime time, because they were pretty... Yeah. But anyway, so Michael Madsen is Blue.
Yeah. And again, you know, just talking about, sometimes, you know, we mention people's careers and everything. I mean, yeah, Michael Madsen is a guy that has, you know, literally been around working in some capacity since his, like, you know, early 20s, and now is 61 years old, and his IMDb page, you know, for instance, is a mile long. Mm-hmm. He's got like, I mean, damn near like 20 projects, you know, either in pre-production, filming, or post-production, so you're going to see him or hear him because some of this is voiceover stuff, you know, anywhere, everywhere. But definitely done some really, you know, great stuff, sort of that that classic kind of early 90s, you know, mobster, you know, sort of neo-noir kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whether it's like Reservoir Dogs or Donnie Brasco. The original Steve McQueen film, The Getaway, is fantastic, damn near masterpiece. Everyone should go see it. The Alec Baldwin, Kim Basinger remake is kind of terrible.
Is the Alec Baldwin Basinger remake?
Yes. But Michael Madsen plays if you're familiar with the original Getaway, like, it's kind of iconic role. And honestly, the remake is damn near a shot-for-shot remake, except for, like, a sex scene that they added in.
Sure.
Which isn't even Alec Baldwin and Kim Basinger. It's just two body doubles. So it's just kind of like, alright.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's great in it. Like, he's really, really good in it. He's the best part of the movie. Until they get to the end, and then I think Richard Farnsworth shows up as a truck driver who, like, gives the two of them a ride, and he's clearly afraid that he's gonna, like, get killed, because he can tell, like, they've got guns, they've got bags of money, and, you know, gets in the car with him. And I'm gonna spoil the ending, because you just shouldn't see the film, but it's a classic moment, because he clearly thinks that he's gonna get killed, and Alec Baldwin kind of looks at Kim Basinger, and she kind of smiles, and then turns and he looks at the guy, and the next thing you see is the two of them driving off in the old man's truck, and the old man's standing on the side of the road with, like, a pile of money in his hands.
Is that, I may be mixing this up with another Kim Basinger movie. Is Rip Torn in this movie?
God, I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. So yeah, Michael Madsen plays Blue, and immediately Blue is clearly the ringleader here, getting everybody to make fun of Jimmy, and, you know, throwing the R-bomb around, calling him dummy. And
Ricky rhymes with Ricardo.
Yeah. Yep, that's right. There was a chestnut. Anyway, so clearly we get in the setup here that it's not going to be an easy work environment for him. As excited as Frank is, you know, it's interesting, because we could certainly talk about, is Frank a little selfish here? Is Frank being selfish in a way? I mean, obviously we can sit here and we can say it's better for Jimmy to be out of the institution than in the institution, especially with some of the information we get later.
Sure.
But it does kind of make you wonder, is Frank being selfish, bringing his brother into this environment, you know what I mean? Like, getting him this job at this place, knowing all the stuff he's going to come up against. Or is Frank just being extremely optimistic with, like, because he even says to Jimmy at one point, they just don't know you yet, you know? And it's like, he's hopeful too, in the same way that Al is saying, you know, you need to make friends at work. I think that Frank is advocating for that as well.
I think you can be both.
Sure.
I mean, one, it is very self-serving, because he feels like he can accomplish something that their dad was not able to accomplish, like the sense of pride, like, I was able to do this. But also at the same time, like, if you're going to get your brother out of the institution and put him to work, what better way to do it than having him work with you, and you can keep an eye on him,
right,
and be an advocate for him with your coworkers.
No, that's very, yeah, it's very true.
But yeah, so we get this first scene where Sam is at work, and he's pushing stuff around, and Al shows up, like, here, like, that's what you're there to do. Like,
yeah.
You're here to make friends.
There's this interesting moment where he makes the comparison between what Jimmy's doing and what Jackie Robinson did.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also this kind of funny moment, because Al brings up Jackie Robinson, and Sam's like, the singer? Like, thinking of Jackie Wilson. Because
yeah.
His Swiss cheese brain doesn't even remember Jackie Robinson.
See, I thought he was thinking of Smokey Robinson.
Oh, maybe. No, I think it was the... Well, it could be either way.
Yeah.
I'm with Jackie Wilson.
All the way around. Okay, yeah.
Anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it is also interesting, because, like, as he's going along, Sam is talking to Al, but Jimmy's also talking to himself.
Yeah.
And there's one extra in the background who is acting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, he looks at him once.
Yeah.
Turns around, starts walking away, and then looks again.
And again, yeah. I mean, that guy has a great look. Like, to pick, like, the one extra to, like, be the one to, like, kind of give insight of like what everybody else, everybody else is saying. Like, yeah, Jimmy's just talking to himself.
Right.
There's also a great moment in the scene of where Sam's saying, like, me, like, integrating Jimmy, like this could take weeks. And Al going, like, what else you going somewhere? Yeah. What else you doing?
Right. Which is true. You know, you get the sense that, it's interesting. It's an interesting comment just on the series as a whole, because you start to wonder, it's like, is Sam now almost programmed in a way to get there, do the task, move on? You know, like, he's not used to staying in one place for too long. Although, you could argue that in Thou Shalt Not, between the final scene proper and then the actual final scene, like, when they're at the beach house, the end there, and then the ending of the episode,
sure,
that there's got to be some time between those.
Sure.
So it's interesting to think that, like, you know, in some of these instances, and kind of like what you're talking about with Disco Inferno, like, he's probably been there for a little while between the accident on the set and when he leaps out. So, I don't know, but there is sort of, is Sam starting to get, like, a workman-like mentality of, like, leap in, do the job, leap out. And so for him, the concept of having to stick around and really dig deep and, like, I don't know. It's one of the things that in the confines of the TV show you couldn't really explore as much, but I think a couple of the novels definitely did, where, like, he spent some time.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, like, he's there for, like, months, which is something that we never see in the TV show.
Yeah, maybe because of the constraints of the TV show. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. But anyway, so, yeah, he says, like, this could take a long time, and then that's when, I think it's Blue who comes out, and then, like, runs into the thing that Sam is pushing, and he says, a long, long time, and then we go into a commercial break.
That's right. And then we get this really sweet scene where they're having lunch, and Sam got an egg salad sandwich, and Frank got pickle loaf. Yeah, Frank does not want the pickle loaf.
He's not happy, yeah. And this is one of the scenes that annoyed me with Frank, and it's one of the things I was talking with Betsy, my wife, as we were watching. Like, on one hand, it is annoying, but on the other hand, like, it is, like true to life, living with someone with disability. Like, Frank wants him to be an adult, but he also, like, treats him like a kid. He keeps doing things, like, through the scene, like, trying to distract him to steal his lunch stuff. And it's
look,
like,
at the seals!
It's like, you're not giving him the respect that you want other people to give him by doing these weird things.
Well, and I think probably for Frank, that part of that might also just come from the fact that that's his brother. And that whereas Frank, you know, and he were at one point in time, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old together, that while Frank progressed past that point, that in Frank's eyes, you know, and certainly in a lot of other people's eyes, that Jimmy never did. So Frank probably just as his brother is just used to treating him like that 12-year-old kid.
For sure.
For the past, you know, whatever, 15 years or so.
Sure. Yeah.
So that could be part of it. But I do get what you're saying, though. Yeah, there's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's in this scene we get the information that... that having to put Jimmy into Wayside, the institution, was the hardest thing that his dad had ever done.
Right.
And, like, you know, wish you could see him now, and, you know, we're going to turn this around. Yeah. So they go to split the Twinkie. Sam goes to open the Twinkie, and he knocks Frank's coffee thermos.
Yeah. And then, you know, he says that Connie gave it to him for Christmas. And you could tell Frank's upset.
Yeah.
But then, you know, he just looks at me like, it's okay, don't worry about it.
Sure.
And Frank does that a lot. Mm-hmm. And you have to wonder, it's like, that's not good for Frank.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, if we're looking at this and thinking about Frank, like, it's not good for him to have to do that. Now, I understand why he's doing it. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I would rather him do that than, like, fly off the handle like Connie
and explode,
or something.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you gotta think, it's like, man, you know, Frank is basically giving Jimmy a free pass on anything that might happen, any of these accidents that might happen, which, again,
for
I'm
sure.
certainly not criticizing him for it. I'm just saying that you got to think about his well-being. Like, there comes to a point where probably, like, Frank should be able to, like, kind of stand up and be like, you know, it's okay, as opposed to, don't worry about it. It's nothing. It doesn't mean anything. You know, he's just blowing
for
it
sure.
off like that.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want Jimmy to feel bad.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But it's like, I mean, just like anybody can.
Right.
You know,
well, clearly,
because
it's Sam that it did it.
Yeah.
And going back real quick, one thing that I wanted to mention, because I actually wondered as I was watching the episode, I was like, God, was that an ad-lib? Because it was a really sweet moment. Is that, the sandwiches. You know, Frank, like, tricks Sam and steals a sandwich, switches sandwiches with him. And so Sam's like, I don't want to eat the pickle loaf. And so Jimmy's like, all right, like we did when we were in school, you know, we split each take half. And so all of a sudden, when Sam's going to pick it up, he just says, okay, but you take the dirty half. And it's because the way that it's said and the way that, like, he picks it up off the, like, the dock as opposed to being on the wax paper or whatever, kind of made me wonder. It's like, I wonder if that's in the script.
Just like a little moment just slipped in.
Yeah, and it's great because, you know, the John Frank, he kind of takes it up and he's like, I'll take the dirty half, you know.
Yeah.
It's a nice little moment.
Yeah.
And then they go to split the Twinkie. Yeah.
And going back to, like, him knocking the cup into the water.
Mm-hmm.
If that was my brother, I would get mad. But then I would get mad and say, well, it's not really your fault. I shouldn't have had the cup on the next to the dock.
Yeah.
So that's on me instead of saying, you know what, that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I said, I'm totally fine with that. I think it's great that that's what Frank does. It just makes me wonder. It's like, is that healthy for Frank to keep kind of like just, you know...
To keep it in?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, he doesn't for long.
Well, that's
I'm not saying give him a pass. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
You gotta... Part of this is your fault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, because almost immediately, you know, after this, we get the moment where Sam is worried about Connie accepting him or whatever, and one of Frank's response is like, she just didn't grow up with somebody like you.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think, for Frank, he's just so conditioned to dealing, you know, to being able to, like, deal with Jimmy that when stuff like this happens, it's probably the reason why he's just like, it's fine.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, there's also a lot to be said is like, you know, growing up with Jimmy, there probably were a lot of accidents where Jimmy accidentally broke stuff. And like, even though you understand like why it's happening, it's like, the thing gets broken again. You know?
Right.
You know, that built up frustration. But.
Right. And there's a really great moment that's coming a little bit later that we'll talk about where Sam is clearly dealing with it too. And you know, he's frustrated. But before that, Sam goes back, he's working, he's catching bags, and he's doing, you know, exactly what he's supposed to be doing, but two of the guys decide to throw two bags down instead of one.
Yeah.
So naturally one hits the floor, spills open and everything, and they start giving him a hard time. Blue's giving him a hard time. And Sam's standing up for himself.
Yeah.
I mean, like, how was I supposed to catch two bags?
Yeah.
You know, you threw two. And eventually it leads to Blue getting physical with him, and you know, he's pushing him, he slaps him, and Sam's just
Sam
standing
comes
up
back a couple of good punches.
He just unloads on him.
Yeah.
And of course Frank breaks it up, and you know, then Blue is ready to
keep that dummy away from me. Yeah.
And then we get the clocking out scene. Where, again, Sam is like, I can do this myself. Because Frank wants to do it for Jimmy.
Sure.
And Sam's just like, I can do this. I can do it myself. Let me do it myself. And he messes it up. And it's just like,
Yeah. I mean, it's like, this is where we've hit the point where, like, everybody's looking at you expecting you to screw up. Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
you know, the thing is Frank, even though Frank is like, just said, no, I'm going to do this. You know, okay, fine, give it a try. And he screws it up. Again, Frank is just like, don't worry about it. It's okay. I do it all the time. You know, I mess mine up all the time. We'll get you a new one.
Yeah.
And then they take off. And you hear people, you know, in the background, like,
Every day. Yeah. Extras are acting.
right. But the hits just keep on
coming.
Because they get home, and there's this really great scene. Connie's very happy for him. Like, you get this nice little idyllic moment that, you know, for a second.
Sure.
Corey wants to go play catch. Frank is feeling a little randy, so he says, go play catch with Jimmy, and, you know, starts hitting on Connie. And
we got some advantages.
Right. And she's supposed to be defrosting the roast, which is also this other moment where we get this sweet moment with Corey and Sam, because Sam's like, can't you just microwave it? It's like,
oh yeah,
what's a microwave? And Corey's like, oh mom, it's from Invaders and Mars.
That's it. Nice. Yeah. I think it was when I was watching that with Betsy, and Betsy was like, nice save, Corey.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
It's really sweet, because it also reinforces who Corey is.
Mm-hmm.
And Corey loves, you know, having Jimmy around.
Yeah.
Because they watch movies, they play games, he's the alien when Corey wants to be the space hero, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's the one of the finest moments in the history of the show that comes later.
Coming up here, But we got Betsy and I watch that. We got to laugh at the microwave. Especially, have you guys seen American Hustle?
Yeah.
Jennifer Lawrence calling it the science oven.
Oh God!
Because it takes place in the '70s, when the microwaves are coming out. But she sets something on fire.
I feel very conflicted about that film
and the science. You know what? I saw it once. I had no preconceived notions about it going in. It was a perfectly good one-time movie.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that it would earn the title of overrated for me, because by the time I saw it, I heard so many people talking about how great it was, and I was just sort of like, I've seen Martin Scorsese films before.
Yeah,
and it's not Scorsese, you know, it's David Russell, so it's sort of like, okay. Yeah. And some of the performances are really good, but then some of them I'm just like, the fuck is Bradley Cooper doing sometimes?
Yeah. we may get into this later with the other pop culture thing that comes up in this episode that you just referenced.
Yeah.
I've realized in the last month there is a beauty in just being a casual fan.
Oh, sure.
Yes. Says the co-host of the Quantum League podcast.
Yeah, well,
but there's a beauty of just being a casual fan, because you don't have expectations, you don't have an ownership of the thing where you think you know what is supposed to happen. You can just show up and enjoy a piece of entertainment.
I think it's one of the reasons why I appreciate and love, it sounds so self-serving, my particular brand of fandom when it comes to Doctor Who. Because I love Doctor Who, and I have loved Doctor Who for, you know, 25 years now. So I was like, I became a fan during like the Wilderness years when it wasn't on TV at all. Mm-hmm. The only thing you had were like novels. There weren't even like the audio plays that the Big Finish does or anything.
Sure.
Like, it was just, you know. And when you're watching that show, like, the acting in some cases is terrible. Not just not good, but terrible.
Mm-hmm.
The sets, you know, you get the wobbly sets, you get the bad special effects, you know, the whole nine yards. But you just start to appreciate it and you enjoy it for reasons that I can't even fully define. And then when the new show came on, because in some ways, and I know that there are a lot of people out there that don't agree with this, and then there are some people that hate the old series, it exceeded all expectations, because it, in some ways, the bar was set fairly low when it came, especially when it came to like visual effects and that sort of stuff. So it's just, I love being a fan of it, because I can watch the new series and appreciate it in a completely different way than when I watch the old series and appreciate it and enjoy it, you know. And I think that there's some, it's hard nowadays, especially with, and I know we're going to talk about it later, a particular franchise in general, because we're getting so much of it now, and the comparisons are, you're never going to not.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they're home, they go out to play catch, Connie's going to start defrosting.
Let's go back to my favorite phrase of the entire episode, when Connie is his wife, and she's like, I have to make the roast, and he's like, it takes 30, it takes an hour to defrost.
Yeah.
What are we going to do in an hour?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tying the apron.
Tying the apron strings around him, like that are around her, like around his own waist, so they're like tied together.
I think that's another reason he loves his brother Jimmy, because his brother Jimmy keeps his kid occupied while he can get busy with his wife.
I hadn't thought about that. to your note, what you were saying earlier about Connie, where they could have made her a very one-dimensional character, and she could have just been just very unpleasant in the scene and blew him off. Like, no, like she's stressed out. She's stressed out about having Jimmy living there. But also, she's kind of on board with this sending the kids out to play for an hour so they can get it on.
And she
she
jokes with Jimmy about the microwave thing afterwards, and she's like, well, says, I don't have a science fiction microwave. You get the sense where it's like, I don't doubt that, you know, prior to the episode, prior to Jimmy being brought in, that there were many conversations that took place between Connie and Frank that were just sort of like, honey, it's going to be okay. I don't know. I mean, of course, he's your brother. He's family. I get it. But so you get the real sense from her that while she is having some frustrations, some irritations over it, but she's a good person too, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, Frank's not going to marry a shrew. But in all seriousness, it's a great scene. It's a nice little scene, and while Frank and Connie are hoping to have a little together time.
God, I was praying for it.
And Sam and Corey are having fun playing catch. Football. But then
They have a nice little moment where Sam introduces Corey to the idea of the high five.
And then Sam sets up a play, you know, go to the trash cans, cut left, and go long.
Yeah.
And so he goes out. He's like, go long, go long, go long. And Sam launches the ball, mm-hmm. and it's too high, goes too far for Corey, lands over in the neighbor's yard.
Mm-hmm.
Which also makes me wonder, how big is Frank's front lawn? Like, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. but I digress. But so he goes over, and the kid that the who's out front, who's lawn
sure.
into, immediately starts giving him a hard time.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if you play
with
dummies,
a dummy, you turn into a dummy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give your ball back, et cetera, et cetera. And Corey stands up for Jimmy. They get into a fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sam comes over, pulls the kid off of Corey.
That's when the mom comes
mom
out.
Mom comes out, starts beating him in the back of the head with a broom.
You
get
monster.
Off my son, you monster.
Yeah.
And it's just so,
Yeah. And the entire point of the scene, it sets up like yet another obstacle that they have to overcome, not just at work, but just in general with the neighborhood. With people.
I just thought of something. That was immediately before Frank and his wife was going to get it on, weren't they? So when he ran out there, he was still...
I was watching that scene, I was like, it'd been a while since I've seen this episode. Like, what state of undress are they going to be running out?
right.
They were dressed. They were, yeah.
So they were...
But they were interrupted.
Yeah.
Ah.
I know, it's the worst.
Yeah.
No good. But they come out, and this is, unfortunately, this gives Connie some more ammunition, frankly.
Yeah.
And she's very upset, and she, you know, kind of lets Frank have it, and this is where she talks about, you know, having another child in the house and having to watch him every second, all this sort of stuff. And Frank is just sort of, and justifiably so, Frank is like, he didn't do anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he didn't hit that kid. He didn't.
Yeah.
It's not his fault that Corey got into the fight with the kid. Like, I mean... Maybe you can spin it that way, but ultimately, like, Corey's just standing up for his uncle.
Yeah.
You know, so, but anyway, Connie's pretty pissed, and, you know, she kind of lets him have it. And at this point, you can tell it's starting to get to Frank, too, and we get that even more in the next scene when they're washing the car.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Sam's scrubbing the car, and you know, Frank's like, oh, you're scratching the car, and you know, and then he grabs the hose and he accidentally sprays Frank
right with
and,
it, yeah.
And finally, Frank's just like, just go inside,
yeah.
You know, I'll do this.
Well, yeah.
And it's just kind of like, oh, man,
yeah,
that
and
sucks.
It, yeah, and there's also we get a nice reflection shot in the hub,
yeah,
the tire
oh, yeah.
hub, the tire. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, because. It was called out and like caught in a previous episode. Like sometimes you can see Scott Bakula stepping out of the way, and it was like one of those things. Like he's walking down the truck, and you can kind of see a moment like just before the camera turns away from him, Scott Bakula is stepping out of the way,
yeah.
So the actor playing Jimmy can step into the shot and be the reflection
in
the.
Can get in there,
yeah.
What kind of car was that, by the way?
It's like a Ford
Chevrolet.
Is it a Chevy? It's an old truck.
Mm-hmm.
Appropriate for the time, though, right? Or was it an older truck?
I think it might have been a little bit older even for that time, honestly.
Sure.
Sometimes IMDb tells us on the trivia page, but unfortunately I'm not seeing it today.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Although I am finding out that the poster in Corey's room of the Mighty Thor was apparently released in the late 1980s.
Oh! Well, you know.
Yeah. Oops.
Oh, well.
Oops.
Anyway,
yeah.
So yeah, we have this, you know, the scene with the truck, and this is like when I was watching with Betsy, like I just made some comment about like, damn it, Frank, you're treating him just as bad as anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, he just made a simple mistake, whatever. And not getting too much into it, but Betsy does have a family member who does have like some physical and mental disabilities. So she has experience with that, and so when I made that comment, Betsy was like, you know, like, growing up with someone with disabilities is hard, and sometimes, you
sure.
know, yeah,
right.
sometimes you vent your frustration when, even though you know you shouldn't, it inevitably comes out sometime.
Yeah, well, and this is when we get, it's really been building, obviously, for a while. But we get the build with Frank, and Frank kind of dismissing Jimmy back into the house. Sam decides to help set the table for the pot roast. And even the way that Sam grabs the plates, no one else is around.
Yeah.
The camera's just on him. The way that he grabs the plates, and like you can tell at this point, even Sam is like, I cannot screw up again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I cannot screw up again. And Al's standing there when he turns around,
sure.
and, you know, and Sam's like, don't you know, don't do that to me. I almost dropped the plate. And they start the conversation, and he goes to grab a platter, and he grabs a platter, and he's literally has just talked about screwing up and feeling like he's getting everything wrong, all this sort of stuff. And as soon as he grabs the platter, the door opens, bumps into him. Of course, he drops the platter. It shatters.
Yeah.
Connie's like, that's my grandmother's platter. I'm sorry. And the thing is at this point, Sam has said I'm sorry so many times that this time it's just the way he says it and the way, you know, it's clearly this is all really having an effect on him.
Yeah.
To the point where he's starting to doubt whether or not he can do the mission.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't understand why Connie got upset at Jimmy for that, because that was her fault.
On her.
I agree. I think at this point that
At that point, like, everything's building up. You're going to find anything you can. It becomes self-fulfilling prophecy.
If he put his peas on his fork the wrong way, she would,
you're out of here.
So Al storms outside, or Sam storms outside, Al follows him, and this is when we get...
Yeah, we definitely get kind of like the emotional climax for Al, and we start to really understand why Al's been doing all this, because we get the information that he knew a girl when he was growing up named Trudy, and then she was mentally handicapped, and that she got put into an institution. And he sets it all up like this, and then he tells us that it was his sister.
Yeah.
That, you know, his father had been a construction worker and moved around a lot, so they had to put her into an institution eventually. And then he had to go into the orphanage because his dad got a job in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And so Al was in the orphanage. Trudy's in the institution. Al works hard to get out of the orphanage. As soon as he's out of the orphanage, he goes to get Trudy, and Trudy has died of pneumonia. And Stockwell has a wonderful moment where he, you know, he doesn't break down, but he almost does, and holds it in. Yeah. It's really powerful. It's really nice. And he gets very upset, and he says, you know, how does a 16-year-old girl die of pneumonia in 1953?
Yeah.
And so now we know why the stakes are so high for Al, why Al is like, you have to do this.
Yeah.
Like, you have to make sure that this doesn't happen to Jimmy.
Yeah.
We lost Trudy, we're not going to lose Jimmy.
Yeah. And this is the first time in the series where Dean Stockwell gets something with a lot of dramatic stakes to it. There will be a really emotional episode coming up later on, but we'll talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would almost argue that you do get a hint of this in the sense of in Honeymoon Express, though. A Honeymoon Express, there's a couple of moments there where he's definitely, you know, but this is certainly the most that we get until...
So far,
Until the episode
The episode comes. So we get the stakes, and now we are...
In bed with Corey.
So
Sam, also a really cute thing that gets set up at the very beginning that now we see again, is Sam's wearing these slippers, these moose head...
Oh, the bullwinkle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which I think are cute. And, you know, he takes them off, pops into bed. And he's got bunk beds with Corey, which is also kind of cute. So Corey comes down, jumps into bed with him. They turn the flashlight on. They start to read, like, a horror comic book. And Sam's like, you really want to read this?
Yeah.
And Corey's kind of like, He's like, let me tell you a story.
Yeah.
And so Corey's like, all right, well, let's see what you got. So there's a little bit of a pause. And all of a sudden, Sam says, a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, is the time of rebellion.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, he's doing Star Wars.
There,
like, he's quoting the opening crawl.
He is. And the music, I don't think it's quite the opening theme, but as close as they could get without getting sued.
Exactly. Yeah. Without a lawsuit, you know.
Yeah.
Those words trigger that theme in my head automatically.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's great, and it's something that, you know, I mean, sticks with you. I mean, here I have 28 years on from the episode, and I remember that clear as day from the first time I saw it, so...
Yeah, this is the back to Casual Phantom. When I first saw this episode as a kid, I had no clue, because I didn't see any of the Star Wars until, like, I was in high school.
Oh, wow!
I was late to the party on that, and I think a lot of it was because, like, it had been built up so much that when I saw clips of it on TV... I'd watch it for a few minutes, and I'd be like, this is it? Like, this is what people are up? You know, like...
So I have a couple of interesting Star Wars stories about how I came to it. Mm-hmm. So the first time that I ever saw anything Star Wars was actually one of the Ewok movies, Battle for Endor.
Okay.
It's not great, but whatever. And then there was a cartoon called Droids, which had C-3PO and R2-D2 in it. And so I'd seen those. But I was also at the right age that there were still, like, some Return of the Jedi toys, like, on the shelf. Like,
sure.
Peg Warmly walk in and buy them for like 50 cents or something like that. So I had some Star Wars toys, and but I'd not actually seen the movie. And when I was about 5 years old, I caught the tail end of A New Hope. But because I'd never seen any of the movies before, I thought when they destroyed the Death Star in A New Hope, that that was like the end. So I had it in my mind that I had seen the last few minutes of like Return of the Jedi. Like I saw the last few minutes of like the series.
Everything.
Yeah. And so it was another year or two, I think, before a friend of my mom's gave me a videotape with all three movies on the one tape. Because she, like, taped them off of Showtime or something. In fact, I can even remember the Showtime logo in the corner. And so this tape was, like, gold to me, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember putting them in the VCR for the first time and watching all three back to back to back in one day.
That's awesome.
I was like, yeah, I was, like, 6 years old, 6 or 7 years old, and
you were set.
Oh, yeah.
See, to me, like, yeah, I only saw clips of the movies until it was announced that the prequels were going to be coming out.
Okay.
And that's when they released the original movies, like all of these, like, special edition VHS tapes where the extras were always, like, after the after the movie. And so it was, like, tail end of high school, first of college is when I actually saw the Star Wars movies all the way through for the first time.
So my grandfather bought me a box set of the tapes. This would have been like 95, 96, when they had just announced, I think, maybe 97, somewhere around there. They had just announced that they were going to do the prequels, but they hadn't actually started doing anything on it. And each of the tapes had Leonard Maltin interviewing George Lucas briefly before the film started. And I remember in the last one, he started talking about the prequels, and he's like, these are the movies I'm writing now, and, you know, this sort of stuff. Those tapes were the last time that the original trilogy was released unaltered in any form up until about a year or two ago. So I was able to sell this box set of video cassettes for like $75 in like 2005.
Yeah.
Somebody bought video cassettes in 2005 at a premium price because it was the only way to get the unaltered films.
You know, now that I think about it, I totally forgot that they went back and they redid the special effects on the first one. Yeah, the videotapes I got were...
And they even advertised. I remember they even advertised the box set before it went out of print. That you could see it on TV. There'd be ads for it and say, own the original trilogy for the last time.
Yeah.
I hate to be this guy, but I would have been the guy that paid $70.
Oh, no, yeah. But now I do have, later on, like, I have a DVD set that it's each one of the original trilogy.
Yes.
Special edition and the original.
Right,
yeah.
The thing that sucks about that, and this is not a Star Wars podcast, but the thing that sucks about that is, unfortunately, they haven't been remastered in any way. So you're getting, like, the quality of them, even if you've got, like, the Blu-ray box set or whatever, the quality on the originals, the unaltered originals, is, I mean, I won't say it's terrible, but it's almost terrible compared to what any other movie looks like, because Lucas for the longest time disowned them. He's like, those aren't my movies.
The special editions
are the movies. So you can't get, like, remastered, like, high-definition quality of the original unaltered trilogy. Now, actually, that might not be true anymore. They might have fixed that last year. When Disney bought the franchise, I think they might have fixed it.
Sure.
I don't know.
You know what else they haven't remastered?
What's that?
Holiday Special.
Well.
I can't even believe you brought
this
up.
I'm just saying, you know. Nothing goes with Christmas turkey like a lightsaber.
Anyway.
So he tells Corey the Star Wars story.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then the next day, Sam's doing a good job.
Yeah, he's doing
Charlie's
great.
Really,
he's
happy with
it.
Him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then we have this moment where Blue comes in, starts picking on him. Mr. Samuel comes in, says, hey, pull this crate.
And he identifies it with a number. He's like, pull crate
1675. Yeah. And so you can tell by the close-up they do on Michael Madsen that Blue is having some trouble figuring it out. He pulls the wrong one. Sam tries to
help him.
To do him a solid.
Yeah.
You know, I was watching it this time, and it's like, you know, if I was Sam, I'd be like, wait.
Yeah.
I'm just going to let him do this up on his own.
Yeah.
Sam's doing him a solid by stepping in and trying to correct him. And, yeah, it turns out that Blue had pulled 7516.
Right.
Instead of 1675. What kind of system you have set up where those two number crates are sitting relatively close to each other? Hey, anyway.
Who am I? Who am I to judge the Oakland Dock Workers Association?
For sure. Yeah. But anyway, so Blue pulled the wrong crate, and so Mr. Samuels just said, hey, you know, just read the numbers.
Yeah. Well, and he, you know, and he ends up saying that he's like, "Oh, I thought you pointed at this crate." Yeah. He's like, "Just read the numbers," and you know, and then of course, you know, Blue is clearly a little miffed by all this. Sam is mopping the floors. And
later. And this is where he has like the voiceover, like, "Hey, I think I'm turning this around," yeah, whatever. Yeah.
And then Blue comes screaming down the way in the forklift and spins out and smashes into, you know, everything turns out to be fine. There's solvent on the floor. It's been left. The tap's been left on.
Yeah.
Of course, they blame Jimmy for it. Charlie's like, "I gotta let you go." Frank's like, "If you let him go..."
Well, like, Blue leads the charge. Right. I mean, he says, like, I will work here, get this dummy out of here. And so Mr. Samuel's hand is kind of forced.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, Frank is trying to stand up for him and say, like, "Hey, if you fire him, you're firing me too." And eventually, you know, that's what Charlie's like, "If you gotta go, you gotta go." Yeah. So they leave, and you know, Frank is handling it all pretty well. I think part of that probably just has to do with the fact that he sacrificed his own job out of the love for his brother. Yeah.
So yeah. So we have this scene where actually they're walking to the truck and Frank kind of blows up, where Sam's trying to tell him, like, "No, like, I didn't turn on the spigot. Like, I had to turn it off." And like, Frank flat out says, you don't know which way you turn it. You don't know nothing."
Right. And he gets mad at him and he he says that he can't watch him all the time. When they get home, of course, you know, Frank breaks the news to Connie. He's like, "You know, it's going to be okay. I'll get another job." You know, and she's like, "What happens when Jimmy messes that job up too?"
And how long it's going to take for you to get in good with that job before you can get Jimmy an interview.
And things are looking pretty grim here. Yeah. You know, like, it's starting to look like Jimmy's, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that Jimmy's not going to make it. And Sam is feeling pretty bummed out about all of this. He's helped Corey fix his bike, though.
Yeah.
Corey goes off riding his bike.
And so that's when Frank comes out and breaks the news, like, "You know, it's going to take a while before I can get a good job. I have to send you back to the institution while that happens." And Al drops the information that if you go back in,
you'll never come out.
Jimmy never gets out. Yeah.
Yeah. And then...
So they hug and Sam says, "Okay." And I was like, okay. Frank walks away. And that's when it's revealed that Sam took the opportunity to hug him to lift his keys.
Yoink.
Sam Beckett, quantum physicist, medical doctor,
pickpocket. So he hops in the truck and tears off, and they're like, he doesn't know how to drive. Corey tells him, you know, where he went. Corey takes off on his bike after him.
Yeah, he's going to get his job back.
Yeah, he's going to get his job back.
Uncle Jimmy's going to get his job back.
And so obviously everybody's going back down to the docks, and Sam gets there and he's trying to convince Charlie to rehire him. Corey's climbed up on some crates to watch the whole thing.
And so this is where, I mean, Sam shows up and, like, explains to Dr. Samuels that Blue is dyslexic.
Is he a doctor?
Yeah.
You just said Dr. Samuels for the...
Did I say that? Dr. Sam.
I know.
Sam,
I just think it's funny because now all of a sudden, like, the guy who runs the docs is a doctor.
Hey, you know. It's possible.
He's a doc.
Doc.
I see what you did.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just going to throw this out here real quick. So I found out I'm going to be a dad, so I'm just trying to work on all the dad joke material on the show.
Hey!
So for the next few months, you're just going to have to deal with it. So Blue, of course, denies that he left the spigot on. You know, Sam's trying to, you know, convince him, and that's when Sam's like, he's mad because I found out his secret.
Yeah.
And, you know, Blue's like...
And Blue reacts in such a way that Mr. Samuels is like, "Oh, yeah, you're right, yeah."
Yeah, right. And then
where he turns around and says, "Yeah, you and Frank are welcome to come back and work."
Yeah, and of course, you know, Blue's pretty pissed about all this because he's been fired, in essence, because of the dyslexia. And the thing is, Sam does it in a very sensitive way. Like, Sam's like, "He's dyslexic." You know, and Blue's like, "What'd you call me?" And, you know,
sure.
And Sam is like, "No, it's, you know, it's common. It's okay. It's treatable. You know, it's words and numbers and everything are all jumbled to you." And it's at this point in the episode where Sam, who has been fitting in as Jimmy, now starts to do things that Jimmy would not be able to do properly.
For sure, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he gets his job, gets his and Frank's job back. Charlie's really proud of him, actually. They turn the corner. Blue comes careening down at them in the forklift.
Sure.
And Al is like, you know, yeah. Sam, watch out.
During all of this, we have seen that, I mean, I think you mentioned, like, Corey has crawled up on top of some crates or some boxes to get a bird's
eye
view of
this.
Right at the edge of the dock. So Al is just, you know, it's amazing that Sam could figure out that he can't pronounce the word dyslexic, which...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
that was weird.
That weird moment of, like, does Al not know what dyslexia is?
Right?
Yeah. Anyway, it kind of struck me as kind of weird, but, you know, it's one of those comedic moments
right.
that they do.
Sam
the forklift
is
goes through
Charlie,
Al. Yeah.
Pushes him out of the way.
Yeah. And there was also, I mean, it was just like, you know, because we're getting to the end of the episode, we've got to wrap stuff up. There was a weird shot, like, they hadn't really established that Frank and Connie had gotten to the dock.
Yeah.
So there was, like, one weird, like, really quick shot shoehorned in just to establish that Frank and Connie were there.
Yeah.
Just in time to see
right.
Corey get knocked
and Corey
into the water.
Goes, yeah, Corey goes off into the water.
Yeah. And this is the moment that I misremembered. I remembered it was Sam jumping
diving
into the water
in. Yeah.
to save him. And then Frank jumped in. I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, Frank dives in, can't find him, goes back down, comes back up, still can't find him. Connie's screaming. She's losing it.
Sure.
Finally goes in, gets him, finds him. Here's something that I had misremembered, or wasn't, did not even misremember, just didn't know at all. The whole time when you hear somebody, like, giving instructions, it's Sam. Like, for some reason, in my brain, like, I did not connect, but all that tie the rope around him, pull it up.
It is,
Sam's
right.
the one giving directions. Oh. Sam's the one at the very front pulling the rope up. Like,
yeah.
Sam's really kind of leading the charge here with all the other guys. They get Corey up. He's not breathing. And Sam's like, you gotta let me do this. And of course, you know, Connie's like, get away from my child, and, like, carries him over. And finally, like, Sam's like, you know, no, you got to let me do this. Finally, she relents. He starts doing mouth-to-mouth.
Where he says, yeah, they taught it to me at the institution.
That
was his way. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he does the mouth-to-mouth. It's not working. Al's like, try CPR. He starts doing that. At one point, like, he pounds on his chest. And, of course,
sure.
Connie freaks out. You know, he's hurting him, or, you know. Then Sam has this great line as he's working on him, and he's not yet back. And he goes, if you die, you'll never see Star Wars.
Yeah.
Pop! The water
yes.
comes out. Yeah, it's like, that was what it took to bring Corey
to
back.
To bring it around, yeah.
But then Corey's by, and, you know, obviously Connie is, you know, so thankful, and, you know, everybody at the docks, you know, are patting him on the back, congratulating Jimmy, and Sam's like, you know, or Al's like, you did it, you know.
Yeah.
You did
well,
it.
I love, like Sam has some lines like, oh, so was I here to save Corey? And Al goes like, no, like, you were here to get him integrated, to get Jimmy integrated, but Corey was just like an extra bonus.
Yeah.
And it was, the wording struck me weird.
Right?
And that.
Well, and I guess if you think about it, that in the original timeline, if you will, like, Corey never would have been at the docks, most likely, because Jimmy never would have gone back to try to get his job back.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, in a way, Sam is the reason why Corey ended up getting there. So he's the reason why he almost drowned. So I think that, it, you know, if Al were to have pulled Ziggy out and been like, you know, here's what happened in the original timeline, I doubt that Corey ever would have even been
in
peril.
For sure.
Yeah.
Here's a question that bothered me about the episode. Like, when all of that was going down, where was Blue?
You know, that was it. Yeah, he had served his purpose,
right.
and he was done.
So
being let out of handcuffs,
he was having a bad day too, because not only did his secret get revealed, he lost his job,
right.
And I'm pretty sure he's going to be convicted of attempted murder on two counts.
Yeah, well, and in addition to that, he probably pushed, you know, a few thousand dollars worth of goods into the ocean when he crashed into the crates.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yikes.
Blue's having a bad day.
He's, yeah.
And all he had to say was, you know what? I am dyslexic.
Right.
I should go get help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do have a little trouble reading.
That would have made it the very special episode.
Yeah.
Oh, you are right.
And then Jimmy, and then the last scene is actually Jimmy and Blue, like, learning to read together.
Yeah.
Like,
that, yeah. That, you know, like, watching this episode.
Or Jimmy teaching Blue to
how to read. Ah.
Oh,
you know, watching this episode, like, Blue reminded me, I had this person in my life when I was a kid that was alternately my bully and my friend. And it was just whatever day that I caught him on. And I totally forgot this until I was rewatching this episode, but I don't know about grade school, but I think like starting in middle school on, he was in special ed. So he had some kind of learning disabilities. It wasn't like Down syndrome where just like by the appearance of the face where it was evident.
Right.
But he did have some kind of learning disabilities that he was in the special ed department separate from us. But there was a moment when I was a kid, I won't like dive into it, but I just saw the way that his dad treated him.
Mm.
And like later on, like realizing that he did have learning disabilities, that even when I was a kid, I was like, oh, that's why you're a bully.
Yeah.
Like that's why, I mean, it's, yeah, damn. I mean, you're a pain in my ass because I'm the one that you're bullying.
Right.
But like, yeah, this is why, who you are. Yeah.
It's like that episode. It's funny, I've thought about How I Met Your Mother like 3 or 4 times during this episode, but it's like that episode of How I Met Your Mother where it's like the chain of screaming, where it's basically like the boss screams at you, then you scream at the person who works for you, then they scream at the, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, yeah, that's absolutely true. And I know that it's so hard when you're in that situation, when you're being bullied. But it's actually something that I've thought about quite a few times, over the, you know, past 10 years or so, about people that bullied me when I was in junior high school in particular, and just kind of looking back and thinking about, you know, where they were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, not having the sensitivity or the awareness to think about that really, and to just instead be pissed off because somebody was bullying me, you know, mm-hmm. and not knowing what to do about it. And, mm-hmm. and it's just sort of like,
yeah,
man, if we just would have sat down and had a conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I went back when I look at like all of the bullies I had, because I was an unpopular kid, picked on a lot. Like when I look at the bullies and
you and me both, buddy.
Yeah, and see where they wound up. I was like, oh yeah, I can kind of see. But the epilogue of that story is, I went to my 20-year class reunion a couple of months ago, and you know, I hung out with this.
Yes,
it was fun.
Yeah, mine'll be coming up in a year. I don't know if I'm gonna go or not, or you know, I'm so far removed now from that place and those people that,
sure.
to be honest, I'm friends with a couple of them on Facebook, but it's like I almost wonder if I would be contactable. You know what I mean? Like if they would, like if when they put that sort of thing together, you know, it's
yeah.
like.
You know, what's funny how our reunion came together is that one of my friends, like he just posted some memory. He posted something on Facebook just basically saying, hey, I miss you guys. I'm glad that we all went to school together. I'm glad we knew each other. And a bunch of classmates jumped in and, you know, commented. And I commented, this probably counts as our 20-year reunion, doesn't it? And I think like that actually spurred like a couple of people who still live in our hometown. Yeah. Like they organized the thing.
Let's do it.
And they did it. And it was like a really low key thing. It was one of those things like I wasn't going to go back, but one of my friends made such a big deal out about
sure.
it. And I realized like if I don't go, like his feelings are going to be hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went. It was like a really low key thing.
Sure.
But I'm very glad.
Yeah,
that I went.
Yeah, it's funny actually. I'm going to be in Charlotte because I went to high school in this town called Gastonia, which is right outside of Charlotte, North Carolina. And I'm going to be down there in a couple of weeks for work. I'll be there for like 5 days, and I haven't even really reached out to anyone yet or anything like that. But I probably should. I'll be there. I'll have enough time, you know,
for sure. I mean, it was kind of hard for me to go back because my hometown is one of those towns that ever since Trump got elected, it has let its racist freak flag fly.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it'll be interesting because I haven't been down there in quite a while. And, you know, when I lived there, the bulk of the time that I lived there, Clinton was president. Everybody was happy. Everybody had a boat. Everybody had 2 cars in their garage. Nobody was bitching about politics in the same way. There was definitely some racism, you know what I mean? I mean, you go to the flea market and there'd be that one guy at the flea market selling, you know, KKK pamphlets and, you know.
He sold the pamphlets? He sold anyway,
he was an entrepreneur. But yeah, so it'll be interesting now to go back there, because the last time I was in North Carolina, actually, it was before the election, but there was definitely reading the newspaper and reading about who's like being considered for governor or whatever. But I think they have a Democrat governor now, or the city has a Democrat mayor or something. I can't remember, one of the two. Anyway, I was very surprised by that, but I remember being down there because that's where Jess's mom's family's from, and reading the paper, and I'm like reading the paper, and I'm just sort of like. What the fuck is that?
Yeah, one last note I'll make about my hometown and newspaper, then we should probably start wrapping this up.
Sure.
But when Obama got elected the first time, the headline of my hometown newspaper was Illinoisan ascends to presidency.
Wow.
Couldn't even say his name, huh?
Didn't want to say his name, didn't want to acknowledge the fact that he was black. Illinoisan ascends to presidency. And of course, that had to be the headline, but they made the headline story as small as possible. And the primary story on page one that day was there was going to be a meeting of the city council where they were going to talk about whether or not it was legal to drive golf carts down the street of town.
You fucking kidding me?
Wow. No, I am not. For a while, I had it saved, and then I threw it out.
I'm surprised they didn't just go and say John McCain does not win presidency.
Yeah, like, they would. This is what I'm going to say. Like, I grew up in White County, Illinois, and they like to keep it that way. Anyway, we should probably bring it around to this.
So Jimmy, yeah.
So I forgot like how quickly this episode wraps up. Like boom, 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 and
absolutely
we're out of here.
In fact, I would venture to say, and I think that there are a few episodes in the series that are like this, I don't know if it could have sustained itself as a two-parter, but I wouldn't have minded 10, 15 more minutes more, you know, a couple more scenes, I could have seen this being like an extended episode, you know what I mean? Like, the show is being made today, you go onto Netflix and sometimes you see, oh, that episode's 47 minutes, oh, that episode's 55 minutes. Like, this could have been a 55-minute
episode. Yeah, they could have gone a little bit longer.
Yeah, I would have been fine with it.
For sure. Now, to be kind of somewhat cynical, like, we get to the end, and Jimmy gets everyone to accept him by saving Corey's life, and just because, you know, it's just after the holidays, and we watched it recently, watching this with Betsy the other day, and I'm like, this is the mentally handicapped Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Oh, shit.
This is... he's not accepted until he does something... Not just for being a human being, but he has to do something incredibly useful before he's accepted.
Yeah. Damn, you can't get accepted unless you save a fucking life?
you know,
Superman.
I know that is a very cynical view, but...
No, but there I get what you're saying. And it is true. I mean, let's face it. While I will argue that it's nice that he gets... I mean, again, it's difficult because he gets Charlie to accept him, you know, the boss to accept him by pointing out, you know, what really happened with Blue. But yeah, it takes saving Corey's life.
And they do that because, like, it's an
even
hour...
Even Connie to accept him.
Yeah, it's an hour of television. You got to have kind of like the...
Right.
The pseudo-action set piece. There you go.
Well, and that's one of the things about Thou Shalt Not that I actually love. The finish of Thou Shalt Not, I think...
Is not that.
Yeah. It's definitely... It's an hour of television. You got to end the show. But there's something else there that I really appreciate, and I like the fact that it doesn't feel like these people are completely healed and everything's okay. It feels like they're on the road to that, and I really fucking appreciate that. Like, it's good writing, it's good directing, it's good acting. You know, that's the other thing. It would be very easy for those actors to probably just be like, oh, everything's great again. And instead, it's, you know, there's more weight to it. I think that's great.
Yeah.
But yeah, overall, Jimmy's a great episode. It's you know, I don't know if it's going to make people's top 10 lists when it comes to Quantum Leap. I think it can. I think it could. I wouldn't argue if it's on people's top 10 lists. But it's a great episode.
I think. If they made a list of like the 10 most iconic episodes of the series, I'm sure like this one would fall.
Yeah. Well, because again, it's another one that gets used in the opening credits a lot. Like Sam in the
football scene. I think.
I thought it was Sam in the pajamas at the beginning.
No, the one that shows up a lot during the Saga Cell, when we finally get to the Saga Cell, is like him hunched over with Corey, like telling him like, "Hey, you're gonna run down, go to the trash can or whatever." Like it's okay. That. Yeah.
It's
like
just stuck. I guess maybe it's just the image of him in the pajamas is stuck in my brain. But yeah, it's a great episode. I like it.
Yeah. I enjoyed it. It's really like between this block and Thou Shalt Not, which we're both recording on the same day. Like, I remember being kind of like Thou Shalt Not being like, eh, and Jimmy like a really strong episode. But I think coming back and rewatching both episodes now as an adult, I kind of think Thou Shalt Not is a stronger episode.
Thou Shalt Not is kind of special, I think. I think there's a lot about that episode that is just like, damn. I mean, they had, everybody was firing on all cylinders in this one. You know, even our creepy Bob Ross as a sexual predator.
I saw the Bob Ross thing too. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah.
Who's your guys' like favorite character? Because mine was the kid. He was so pure and innocent, and like he just loved Jimmy so much.
He, you know, and he reminded me so much of Fred Savage in The Wonder Years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's a wonderful thing. I wonder how much casting was like, get me Fred Savage.
Right?
Get me not Fred Savage, Fred Savage.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. How funny is that? Fred Savage at 11 years old was already the, get me somebody like Fred Savage.
Savage, yeah. Yeah. We got the Corky episode.
Yeah.
Oh.
Get me Fred Savage.
Oh, Lord.
Give me his non-union Mexican equivalent.
Oh, my God. That's the conversation that took place in the casting room.
Yeah. Oh, and on that note.
Yes. So, Jimmy. Jimmy's great. I like Jimmy a lot. I'm going to mention a spoiler. So, to spoil something that happens later, we will see Jimmy and Frank and Connie and crew again a couple of times, actually. And I believe end of third, beginning of fourth season, there's a little bit of an allusion to them.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And then we get like a direct sequel to this episode, which is really one of the very few times that happens. And it's part of like an arc of episodes that is somewhat controversial among some fans, I think.
It is, yeah. I was telling Chris off mic, yeah. Yeah, jumping ahead the fifth season, the episode Delivers from Evil. Yeah. Takes a weird turn halfway through.
Yeah.
Because it's the last season, and they were just throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall, trying to get something to stick.
Oh, and I really can't. I can't wait till we get there. I mean, I can, because of wanting to experience the rest of this that we're doing, but I'm looking forward to when we get there.
Yeah.
And then, as we were actually talking about, too, in the final episode...
So they come back in a...
In a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. So I think that... I think all that said, yeah, that there is something kind of iconic about this episode, and the fact that they would revisit these characters, these people, is a testament to that. So yeah, that's all we got. Unless we want to talk about Star Wars for, like, 10 minutes.
Oh, we could just go on forever.
I think the consensus in the room, though, off mic, is that everybody enjoyed Last Jedi.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you're a hater out there... Let us know on our Facebook.
Well, yeah, Facebook, Instagram, at FateToyReal.
No, thank you all for listening, and we will be back
next time.
So help me God. Which we didn't actually talk about, the leap out. He leaps into an attorney standing next to a young black woman, and there's a judge asking how she pleads.
Guilty or not guilty?
For the charge of murder.
For the murder.
Definitely in the South. The hot and sticky South, for sure. And... Sam just turns and looks at her and is like, murder. And that's it. So we'll get into So Help Me God next time around.
Yeah. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Yeah,
thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, good to have you back. We'll definitely get you back in here again. So
all right.
Cool. All right.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed what you've heard or have any questions or comments, don't be shy. Reach out to us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And remember to hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may be listening. Until next time. Can't see, you'll never know.